Welcome to the infamous podcast, Bitch, I'm Not Well. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Brandy.
And we're invested on taking you down to Crazy Town, where we talk about crazy bitches who are truly unwell.
So this is kind of a close case for us. It happened in Fort Worth, Texas, which is about a 5 to 6 hour drive for us. Yeah. So this case is known as the Fort Worth Trio case, and the incident happened on December 23rd, 1974, almost 51 years ago.
I was 4 years old.
You were? Did you hear about this case when you were four?
I don't think I did.
You don't remember? The people involved in this case are Mary Rachel Trelica, 17 years old, who went by her middle name, Rachel. Mm-hmm. Lisa Renee Wilson, 14 years old, who also went by her middle name, Renee. And Julianne Mosley, 9 years old, who went by her first name, Julie. In the 1970s, Fort Worth was a large city, but it still had the small town feeling. Everyone knew their neighbors. Kids were allowed to play outside without having to worry they would be kidnapped or murdered. And it was just kind of a nice place all around. It's always nice to be able to go outside and not get murdered.
It is nice to let your kids out and play and not have a second thought about it.
Yeah.
Not today.
Not today. That does not happen today. This sounds crazy now, but in the 1970s, people in Fort Worth didn't feel like they had to lock their doors at night. So to put this in perspective for you, the crime rate in Fort Worth as of 2024 was a 1 in 31 chance of becoming a victim of crime. Fort Worth crime rates are 40% higher than the national average for both violent crimes and property crimes. Their crime rate is also 21.7% higher than the state of Texas's average crime rate, and the murder rate is 81.8% higher in Fort Worth versus Texas overall state rates.
Wow.
Yeah.
Currently today.
It's real
Holy
bad.
Moly.
So you should probably be locking your doors at night based on these statistics.
If you're not already.
If you're not already, you probably should. It would be a good idea.
Yeah, I don't even want to visit there.
Oh, no, me either. I don't want to visit Houston right now either with the maybe serial killer, maybe not serial killer going on.
I didn't hear about that.
They found 16 bodies in a bayou.
Yes.
And I listened to a YouTube video on it yesterday.
Yeah.
They've actually found like 60 something in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And is that where the mayor's like, nothing to see here, folks?
Yeah.
There's no serial killer on the loose. These are just people that fell into the bayou.
Yeah.
Of their own accord.
There's nothing going on. They're all different people. There's nothing to link them together.
Nothing to see here.
But they did show something, and it was like more. Maybe like 80% of them were males between the ages of like 30 and 45 or something. They're like, you know, based on these, it does look like there's a pattern with some of them.
Yeah. Houston, we're coming at you hard.
Yep. You'll be on our next podcast episode.
Yeah.
Or maybe not the next one. It'll take me a while.
It'll be a minute.
In 1974, Rachel and Renee were both students at Southwest High School. Rachel was a senior and was married to a man named Tommy Trelica.
She was married as a senior?
She was.
Okay.
It was a different time. I wonder if she'd have her parents' permission to get married. Or if, like, that was the age of consent in Texas. I'm pretty sure the age of consent to be married in Louisiana is, like, 12.
Wait, what? You threw me off on that one.
A little bit.
I don't think it's that bad.
No, maybe 16, 17?
I don't know.
I'm going
to look it up. Let's get back to that.
Okay. Before she had gotten married and moved out of her family home, Rachel had lived just a few blocks away from Renee. They lived in a middle-class South Fort Worth neighborhood of Greenbrier, and even though Renee was 2 grades behind Rachel, the girls had become good friends, and their families were also close. Rachel and Renee's families would hunt and fish together when the weather was nice. So they knew each other very well. When Rachel had gotten married, she'd moved into a house with her husband just a few minutes away from her childhood home, which allowed her friendship with Renee to continue. I know this case occurred in the early 1970s and times were different, but I find it weird that Rachel was married at 17. Mm-hmm. As far as I found, she was not pregnant, so that isn't the reason she married or was forced to marry by her family. It looks like she genuinely liked Tommy and wanted to marry him, and her family gave their blessing, but their marriage/relationship is not that straightforward.
Mm.
Tommy, who was 22 at the time that he married Rachel, had originally been engaged to Rachel's 19-year-old sister, Deborah.
Wait.
We keeping it in the family.
Oh, that's insane.
Yeah.
I wonder why their relationship didn't work out.
According to Rachel and Tommy, they were just too different for each other.
Okay. Well, you know, that's fair. But you just want to stay in that family. I guess you love the family.
Yeah. Like, these girls are beautiful. If I can't marry the older one, I'm going to marry the younger one. Apparently, they had broken up on good terms or had dealt with any bad feelings because when Rachel went missing, Deborah was living with Rachel and Tommy because she was newly single and needed somewhere to crash until she could get back on her feet.
So I just found out in 1974, the legal age to marry in Texas was 21 without parental consent, but minors could marry with parental consent at age 16 for females and 19 for males.
Dang, so you couldn't get married before you were 21?
Yeah, but you can't have a beer.
Okay.
You still can't have a beer.
Well, maybe that was the thing. They didn't want you to be able to get married without being able to buy alcohol for your wedding.
Maybe.
They're like, nobody's going to go.
Yeah. But if your parents say it's okay,
then they better buy the beer and you can get married.
You can get married, but you still can't go buy the beer.
Damn. Hmm. It's a dry wedding.
Yuck.
There's nothing romantic about that.
We don't like it.
Rachel and Tommy had been married for 6 months when she disappeared. It is thought one of the main reasons Rachel went to the mall that day is because she had found out that morning that Tommy's 2-year-old son from a previous marriage would be staying with them on Christmas, and she wanted to have gifts under the tree for him when he woke up on Christmas morning. I know, that's sweet.
That is sweet.
Originally, Deborah was supposed to go to the mall with Rachel, but Rachel, Deborah, and Tommy had stayed up until 4 that morning, and Deborah did not want to get out of bed, so Rachel called her friend Renee instead. I don't blame her.
Mm-mm.
I couldn't stay up until 4, and then I sure as hell wasn't getting out a few hours later.
Mm-mm.
Renee was at her grandmother's home that morning. Renee normally spent the weekend with her grandmother because she lived across the street from Terry Mosley, Renee's boyfriend's family home. Terry lived with his mother, Rayanne, who was separated from her husband and his siblings. Terry was 16, and he had 2 younger sisters, Janet, 11, and Julie, 9.
Mm-hmm.
That morning, Terry met with Renee at her grandmother's home to give her her Christmas gift, which was a promise ring.
Oh.
Renee asked Terry if he wanted to come to the mall with her and Rachel, but Terry had promised to visit a friend of his that was in the hospital due to surgery and didn't want to back out on visiting him.
Oh, sounds like a very thoughtful guy.
Yeah, that is sweet. Julie had tagged along with Terry to visit Renee, and when Julie heard that Renee was going to the mall, she begged to be allowed to go with her. She called her mom while her mom was working and begged to go. And at first, her mom told her no, but you know how kids can be. And
yes, I do.
They have ways. They wear us down as parents. Yes, they do. They're going to get what they want.
Go, God. Dang.
Just go.
Just leave me alone.
Lose my phone number and go.
Lose my number.
In most people's minds, I would think the 9-year-old child wanted to go with her big brother's girlfriend for a girl's day. Normally, this is an uneventful trip that occurs all the time. Mm-hmm. This time, the outcome was extremely unexpected, though. Before heading to the mall, Terry reminded Renee that they had plans to attend a Christmas party that night, so not to get back too late. Renee planned on being home by 4, so she would have plenty of time to get ready for the party. Rachel pulled up at Renee's grandmother's house around noon in her 1972 Oldsmobile Cutlass.
Ooh, girl.
Yeah, she was smoking. Renee and Julie got in the car, and the 3 were off. On their way to the mall, they stopped at a surplus store so Renee could purchase 2 pairs of jeans that she'd had on layaway.
I love layaway.
Me too. I wish they still had it.
I know. Interest-free.
Yeah, it helped out a lot around Christmas.
Absolutely.
Before leaving the store, Renee changed out of the jeans she'd been wearing and put on a pair of the new jeans. It's believed the 3 left the surplus store and went straight to the mall from there. It's believed by most people that the girls went to the mall because that's where Rachel's car would end up being found. Allegedly, several witnesses claim to have seen the 3 girls inside the shopping center, specifically remembering this unique pale yellow t-shirt that Renee was wearing. The t-shirt had the words "Sweet Honesty" embroidered on the front. However, these sightings at the mall cannot be verified, and we all know eyewitness sightings are notoriously unreliable. Authorities also never made public who these people were that saw the girls or where they saw the girls. As far as I was able to find, at no point did authorities release what area of the mall the girls were supposedly sighted in or what they were seen doing. Were they eating, checking out, window shopping, walking towards an exit? We don't know. None of this was ever made public. If they even know.
Yeah. I wonder how large the mall was.
That's a good question.
You know, back then, when I remember there being a mall, were only like three major stores in it.
Like Sears, JCPenney.
Yeah, the White House, Sears, JCPenney's. A couple of things inside, but it wasn't like a huge, expansive mall.
I'm trying to think. We used to go to the Lafayette Mall a lot when I was little, and it felt like it was huge, but I don't think it was huge.
Yeah, but looking back at it with grown-up eyes, it wasn't big at all. Seems like if you had on a pale yellow t-shirt, like, you would kind of stand out.
Yeah. I'm sure it was packed that day because it was, like, 2 days before Christmas.
Yeah.
Everybody was there getting their last-minute shopping done.
Yeah.
All the husbands were out.
Yeah. All the men were out.
Oh, man. Chris used to wait until Christmas Eve to go get all his shopping done. And he would be so stressed out. And this was before you could order everything online. And I was like, ain't no way I'm going to that mall on December 23rd or 24th. You're lucky if you can get me there all in December.
I had to do it because I was very, very sick with bronchitis 1 year. Ain't nobody got time for that. Horrific. I had fever and I didn't have a mask on. We didn't even know about mask at that time. But yeah, it was a struggle. I couldn't breathe and there were just like people everywhere. You had to kind of twist and turn and squeeze your way through. No. Why would anybody do that to themselves on purpose?
Nope. And he knew every year. He like dreaded it. I'm like, go earlier. Yeah. Why are you putting yourself through this?
December 22nd, he was like, dang, I'm going to have to go shopping tomorrow. Why did I do this to myself?
Didn't realize Christmas was on the 25th. This is crazy.
Remind him now.
Yeah. Don't do that, babe.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Since it has been 51 years since they disappeared, it's extremely unlikely that a new eyewitness will come forward with groundbreaking information. And if someone does come forward, will they be believed? I mean, I can't tell you what I did last week. There's no way I could tell you what I saw 51 years ago at the mall.
Yeah, no way.
I mean, it would have to be something like extreme, like I saw
trip in the food court.
The girls weren't missing for very long when their families knew something was wrong. When they had not arrived back home by 5 p.m., their parents became concerned. Their parents went to the mall to see if they could find them. Rachel's mother was the first parent at the scene. It was Rachel's mother that found her car on the upper parking lot behind a Sears. Her car was locked and everything looked normal. There was no sign of a struggle, no blood, no damage to the vehicle. Everything was normal. Like they had locked it and walked into the mall. Rachel's little brother, who is still investigating the case, remembers going to the mall with his mother and literally going into every store in the mall to see if anyone had seen his sister and her friends. At the time of Rachel's disappearance, Rusty was only 11 years old.
Aww.
Little.
I don't know that I would let him go by himself if I'm already missing a kid.
She was with him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the mom had Rusty with her and they went to every single store in the mall asking if they had seen the girls. Rachel's mother had the girls paged over the sound system, which, if you don't know, paging someone is having a store associate announce over their sound system that someone is missing or is needed at the front of the store.
Rachel, please come to JCPenney's. Rachel, your mother is waiting for you
here. Your mother is waiting for you. Unfortunately, the paging did not bring Rachel, Renee, or Julie to the storefront. They continued to speak to every employee in each store until the mall closed and they had to leave the mall. Which, I mean, it's December 23rd. You know, they've seen a ton of people during the day. Gosh. Like, it'd be hard to remember unless there was, like, something memorable that happened with these girls. It'd be hard to remember if you saw them that day.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
It really is. Rusty recalls his mom being upset and defeated when they were forced to leave the mall around 11 p.m. without finding any sign of his sister and friends. He, however, didn't feel too concerned. He was 11 at the time, and his big sister, whom he thought of as an adult, had to be fine. Bad things didn't happen to people that he knew.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong.
I don't know that I could leave. I'd probably sit in the parking lot with the car.
Yeah. I'd sit there and watch all night. Rusty was used to having a sister who was a little bit rebellious and wild, but it wasn't usually Rachel pulling stunts like this. It was usually his eldest sister, Deborah, that Rusty had grown accustomed to her antics.
Oh, Miss Deborah.
Miss Deborah.
The first fiancé.
At this time, the Fort Worth Police Department did not believe that the three missing girls had encountered trouble. They assumed it was more likely that Rachel, Renee, and Julie had run off somewhere to get away, and they would be back when they ran out of money.
With a 9-year-old.
With a 9-year-old, yeah.
That makes sense.
And, I mean, you left your car. Where are you running away to without your car?
Exactly.
You need all the money you can get, so why would you be spending money on a bus ticket?
And the mall was closed.
Yeah, like...
No.
When the police were able to get into Rachel's car in the parking lot, they didn't find anything suspicious. In the back seat, they found a wrapped present for Rachel's stepson. But this present had already been there, so it wasn't like she had gone in the mall and bought something and come out and put it in her car and then disappeared. It was something that she had already had for him.
Okay, that was my question. How did they know it was there before, I wonder?
I think Tommy knew that it was the present that him and Rachel had already got, thinking that his stepson wouldn't be there for Christmas. They would see him afterwards.
Yeah.
And so that's what they had found in the car. There wasn't anything new that he didn't recognize.
Gotcha.
There was not one of the new presents Rachel had planned on buying at the mall in the back seat. They also found two pairs of jeans, which made sense because Renee had picked these up from the surplus store prior to arriving at the mall. One pair of jeans were the new jeans, and the other were her old jeans she had originally worn earlier that day. Because you remember, she changed.
She swapped out.
Yeah, at the surplus store after she paid off her layaway.
Jeans,
heck
girl.
Yeah. Break them in before the party tonight. Got to be able to dance in them.
Break them in. Loosen up that waistline.
Loosen it up. Fort Worth authorities brought Rachel's husband, Tommy, to the parking lot and had him look around the car and see if anything stuck out. Did you notice anything missing or out of place? But Tommy told officers everything looked normal besides a few items that he had noticed were missing from the glove compartment. The missing items were three $50 bonds that he claimed he had purchased with his first wife, as well as a copy of his parents' will.
What?
Isn't that weird?
That's strange.
Do you normally travel around with your parents' will in your vehicle or bonds that you purchased with your first wife?
Oh my gosh. Oh, we're being pulled over. Can you hand me the insurance card? They're under the bonds.
Yeah. Don't take the bonds out.
Yeah.
I wonder if he was like, there really wasn't any bonds, but maybe if I say these were missing, they'll give me some $50 bonds to replace them.
That's kind of weird that you can drive around with them in your car. And your parents will.
Is it just me that finds it extremely weird that, number one, he had those things in the car, and number two, those are the only things besides the missing girls that are missing?
No.
Like,
it's not just you.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, my wife is missing, and my bond, paperwork, and will. Oh, okay. Tommy's parents had both passed away recently within a year of each other from natural causes. His parents had left him the 1972 Oldsmobile Cutlass, the vehicle Rachel had been driving. He couldn't guarantee either that they had actually been in there that morning. He thinks that they were still in the car and that they were missing, but...
Well, where else would they be?
He would have found them by, I mean, by now. He definitely would have found it if they weren't in there. But if he did find it later on, they never put anything out saying, hey, this wasn't really missing. I found it in the lockbox in the house or something like that.
Holy hell.
Yeah. Tommy told authorities that he wasn't sure if the missing bonds in his parents' will had been in the glove box that morning or if they had been removed at an earlier date that he just wasn't aware of. I mean, I would think that she would tell you, hey, I put your parents' will here. Along with these $50 bonds. They're all right here, baby.
FYI.
The first night the girls were missing, all three of their fathers staked out Rachel's car in the car park all night, waiting to see if the girls or someone involved in the girls' disappearance would return to the car.
Yeah.
They weren't just sitting there. They were sitting there with a shotgun watching the car.
Oh.
Well, yeah, shit was going to go down if they found out somebody was messing with that car and it wasn't their kids. They were prepared to stop anyone from contaminating the scene of the crime and would take it into their own hands if the authorities didn't take them seriously.
There you go.
Authorities were still sure that the girls had just run off for a bit to be rebellious or cool off after a fight, even though all of their family members disagreed with them.
On Christmas Eve.
Yeah, like, I hate when the cops sit there and argue with parents, like, no, they just ran away. I think I would know better than you if my kid would be a runaway or if this is not in her character.
Well, you know that there are lots of instances where kids do run away and then they just show back up at home.
Yeah.
But, and some of the parents are like, oh, no, my kid would never do that. You know?
That's true.
But in this instance, when you have a 17, a 14, and a 9-year-old.
Yeah, and the 9-year-old's not related to you.
And they've made it known that they're going shopping. I mean, would they do go cash in the $150
bonds? And bought some bus tickets. Yeah, like, I guess I'd feel a little different if Julie was actually related to either one of them, like it was their sister or something. But mm-hmm. to just have a random 9-year-old little girl with you.
Yeah.
You're not going to run away. I mean, you're kidnapping.
Yeah, you're ruining my plans, bro.
Yeah,
like,
sorry.
You can't come with us today. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I don't have enough room in my car.
Yeah.
The girls were not rebellious, and no one had been in a fight with them, and Julie was 9. Mm-hmm. Why would they run off with a 9-year-old?
Exactly.
Another point the parents had was, why would they run away and leave their vehicle behind? Surely it would be easier to run away if you had a vehicle at your disposal rather than trying to hitchhike or pay for bus tickets.
Mm-hmm.
The police's runaway theory gained traction the following day, December 24th, when Rachel's husband, Tommy, received a letter in the mail from Rachel. Tommy and Deborah, Rachel's sister, brought this letter to the police. Tommy had found this letter in his and Rachel's mailbox that morning. The letter had Rachel's name written in pencil on the upper left-hand corner of the envelope, and the envelope was addressed to a Thomas Trelica. The letter in the envelope was written in ballpoint pen, and it said, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we just had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week. The car is in Sears upper lot. Love, Rachel." This letter is a major move in the investigation. Had Rachel, Renee, and Julie just left and gone to Houston to get away from everyone? Police weren't sure if the note had been written freely by Rachel or if she had been forced to write the letter. They sent the letter to the FBI lab in Washington for analysis. The letter that was supposedly written by Rachel said the girls needed to get away and went to Houston, but for the families, that didn't make sense. Rachel's family did not think she had written that note. The 10-cent stamp on the envelope had been canceled that morning, so that means that there was a postmark over the stamp, so the stamp couldn't be used again.
So it went through the U.S. mail.
It did. Which, I mean, that's really fast. I don't think I can mail a letter to my neighbor across the street and it get there the next day.
No.
And whoever sent the letter would have had to known that Rachel's car would be parked in the upper parking lot at Sears. Like, so did somebody just take a...
Well, and here's another thing. Like, you know, now where we live, all the mail is sent over, like all of the mail, local mail, is sent over to a U.S. postal facility that's an hour away.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's processed there. Then it's sent back.
Yeah, there's...
But maybe back then...
Maybe it was all local?
It was all local. Like, this is your zip code. This is where you process your mail. It's getting out that morning.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot faster.
Maybe. I'd have to ask old Chatty about that.
Yeah, see if that bitch knows.
Let's pause it.
Pause. Where is it at? All right, so Kelly just looked up what the likelihood of receiving a letter that quickly is.
Okay, so in 1974, if you mailed a letter within Fort Worth, Texas to another Fort Worth address, it very well could have been received the next day because back then it was still handled by local post offices, not routed through distant sorting centers. Now, if the letter were sent, let's say, 120 miles away, then it would have arrived within the next, like, the second day of mailing.
So there's no way she could have mailed it at 2 from 120 miles away, and it would have been there at 8 the next morning.
No.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Possible if it was just maybe an already used
stamp.
That they could have dropped it off in the mailbox themselves.
Yeah.
It doesn't say whether or not it came with other mail.
Mm-mm.
Or during the normal mail delivery time. So maybe it was a stamp that had already been used and just stuffed it in that envelope or was forced to stuff it in the envelope and they dropped it off.
I wonder if they ever checked to see if something else had been originally written on the envelope and then erased, and
good point.
That information was written in.
Good point.
Hmm. I guess we'll never know.
We'll never know.
The postmark would usually show the date the letter was processed and a zip code of the area from which it was sent. However, the last few digits of the zip code happened to be blurred. It appeared as if someone had purposely tried to make the last two digits indecipherable, but based on what they could see, the police felt the letter could have been sent from Throckmorton, which is 125 miles east of Fort Worth, or Weatherford, which is about 30 miles east of Fort Worth. That's not terribly far away, but the fact that they traveled any distance without their vehicle and they sent a letter the day they went missing and it arrived the following morning had my mind spinning. Hmm. Which, after Kelly looked it up, we realized that that can't happen.
Yeah.
So, if Rachel did write this letter, had she planned this out in advance so that the letter would arrive the morning after she left? And that would be, like, a lot of planning.
Yeah, a whole lot.
After receiving the letter, Tommy announced that he was hopeful his wife would be back soon. But Rachel's parents didn't believe that she'd written the letter, and even the police said that they couldn't be sure whether she had written the letter or not. Or, you know, if she did write it, was she writing it under duress?
Right.
Some issues with the letter stood out to the police. For instance, the L at the end of Rachel's name had originally been written with a short loop. The loop was so short that it looked more like an E than an L. It appeared as if someone had gone back over the letter to make the loop longer and taller. There were so many questions and items that didn't make sense in this case. Why was Rachel's name on the outside of the envelope written in pencil, but inside the letter was written in ballpoint pen? Why had she addressed it so formally to Thomas when she always called her husband Tommy? Why was the letter the only piece of mail in the mailbox that morning? Oh, look, I did say that. There was no other mail with it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. There's no junk mail, no Christmas cards, nothing but the strange letter. It was like the letter had been placed in the mailbox rather than mailed through the post office. Christmas Eve is a notoriously busy time for the post office. How had the letter been sent the previous night after the girls had vanished and made it into Tommy's mailbox first thing the next morning?
Crazy.
It is crazy. Authorities did believe that the letter allegedly written by Rachel did match a sample of Rachel's handwriting, but once again, they admitted it was impossible to determine whether or not she had written the letter under duress. Was it possible that Rachel had addressed the letter so formally as a way to get her husband to think it was strange and something must be wrong? There have been several handwriting experts who have analyzed this letter, including the FBI. And most of the time with the FBI, it's come back inconclusive as to whether or not Rachel did write this letter based on her handwriting samples. Somebody who didn't know Rachel would have had a hard time making the handwriting look so much like Rachel's to the point where it's inconclusive when analyzed by the FBI. By the end of December 1974, the girls still had not returned from Houston, and no one had heard from them in the 9 days they had been missing. It was reported that the police were continuing to follow leads, but the quality of these leads was questionable, and no leads had brought any clarity to the case. On December 31st, several pieces of women's underwear were found in a field 6 miles west of Justin, Texas, near a stream. A hunter had stumbled upon these items, and he told the police that he knew the underwear had not been there in that spot on Christmas Day because he had been out hunting then, and he didn't see them. Police were hopeful that these items might be connected to the three missing girls, but after showing the underwear to the parents and them being unable to identify them as any of the girls, it made authorities believe that the underwear had probably just washed down from a nearby garbage dump.
Mm.
On January 1st, a man who had known Rachel called her father and reported that he'd seen all three girls at the mall on December 23rd, shortly before they disappeared. This man claimed that he'd been in the record department of a store in the mall when he'd seen them. He said that he even briefly spoke to Rachel. He said that he noticed there was another person who appeared to be with Rachel, Renee, and Julie, but the newspaper article that gives this information had no further information on who the fourth person in this group supposedly was. The Fort Worth Police Department was running into dead end after dead end, and on January 3rd, the Fort Worth Telegram quoted a detective as saying, "I wish we had just one clue to get us off that parking lot." The article explained that every lead the police followed brought them back to the parking lot behind Sears, and although law enforcement claimed that they had no evidence to indicate the girls had been physically harmed, they did admit that they also had no evidence to indicate that the girls were safe. Other officers told news agencies that they can't get any further than the parking lot. This was their way of saying that there really weren't any leads coming in, at least not anything substantial. At this time, the authorities really had nothing but three missing girls and a car in a mall parking lot. Oh, other officers told news agencies that they can't get any farther than the parking lot. This was their way of saying that there really weren't any leads coming in, at least not anything substantial. At this time, the authorities really had nothing but three missing girls and a car in the mall parking lot. They couldn't even prove that the girls were the ones that parked the car at the mall. Authorities were beginning to show their frustration with this case. There was absolutely no clues pointing in any direction. They had nothing. By the end of January, posters and flyers had been distributed and hung up all around town. You would see the missing girl flyers everywhere. Windows of grocery stores, bars, bowling alleys. Their parents wanted the girls' faces and information in as many places as they could have it. These flyers also announced that there was a $2,000 reward for anyone with information that could lead her family and or the police to the three girls.
That's a lot of money back then.
That is.
You would think that somebody would know something.
Yeah.
Something.
By this time, the police no longer believed the girls had run off voluntarily. On February 7th, Julie's mother, Rayanne Mosley, received a phone call around 11 a.m., When she answered the phone and said hello, she didn't hear anything. So she said hello a few more times. Still, she heard nothing. She admitted that she stayed on the phone longer than she normally would because since Julie was still missing, she was praying she would hear from her.
Mm-hmm.
As she went to hang up the phone, she heard a low moan and a little girl's voice say, "Mama."
Aww.
Rayanne swears she recognized the voice as her daughter, Julie. Rayanne demanded to be told who was on the phone. She asked, "Is this Julie Mosley?" The caller responded, "Yes." She then asked where the girl was calling from, and the girl said she didn't know. After this short back and forth, the call was disconnected. Right before the phone was hung up, Rayanne would hear "Mama" one last time.
Oh.
Rayanne would later tell police that the girl sounded like Julie, but as if Julie had been drugged. Her speech was slow and not normal. At the time, Rayanne told the media that she knew it was possible someone was prank calling her, but she swore that she was positive the voice on the line belonged to her daughter, Julie. We will never know for sure if the person on the call was really Julie or if it was someone playing a mean prank on the missing girl's mother.
That
would be really messed up.
Pisses me off. People suck.
Like, why would you prank call the mother of a missing child? Is that what gets your rocks off?
Yeah. Sickos.
2 days later, a call came through to Renee's parents, and police were able to trace this call to North Richmond Hills. Because the parents were getting so many calls with tips and information on their missing daughters, authorities decided to set up a crew at each house to be on site when these calls came through so they could be traced. Too bad they didn't have this before.
Right. Would have been helpful.
It would have been a little bit. Authority traced the call to a 14-year-old girl that was not Renee. Authorities traced the call to a 14-year-old girl that was not Renee. A Fort Worth police officer told the media that the girl admitted to making three calls to Renee's family. When they answered the call, she wouldn't say anything, and she admitted to making one call to Julie's home where she spoke to the older brother. The girl told him that she was Renee. However, she denied making the call that Rayanne swore was Julie.
Hmm.
That's really messed up. Like, I would beat the shit out of my 14-year-old.
I mean, but why?
Like, there's nothing else that you could possibly be doing right now.
I remember being 14 years old, and, I got a piano that would make fart noises, or, you know, you could speak in it, and it would change your voice to, really high pitch or whatever. And we would do prank calls. I ain't gonna lie. We did prank calls. But never, ever in my wildest dreams would I imagine calling a family that you know is hurting.
Yeah.
At 14, you know.
You have some empathy at 14, you know.
Yeah, some.
You're not an idiot. I bet this girl grew up to be a serial killer.
She did.
I think she did.
Her name is Eileen Morris.
Oh, no! No! In March of 1975, an elderly woman told Fran Arnold, Renee's grandmother, that she had been shopping at the mall on December 23, 1974, and had possibly witnessed the abduction of the girls. She claimed to have seen a yellow truck with lights on top of it, kind of like a pickup that is used in construction zones or security guards at the mall. This elderly lady said she had seen a man and two girls inside this truck. She then saw a second man forcing another girl into the truck. Why would you not tell somebody this?
Not.
This is 3 months after you supposedly saw this.
I don't want to interfere.
Ugh. Like, I would rather.
You see all the flyers around town and you hear it on the news.
It's like, doo-doo-doo, I know nothing.
Mm-mm. Oh, you know? I think I remember seeing some children getting kidnapped.
That sounds familiar.
Into a van. It did look suspicious.
Now that I think about it, 90 days after the fact.
Great job. Mm-hmm. Good job, Louise.
Three separate employees at the mall said that the elderly woman had told them the same thing on December 23rd.
Holy macrimoly.
So you didn't think to tell the mom and the little brother when they went to every single store asking if they'd seen her?
Yeah, that didn't register.
Yeah. I didn't see them, but
have
there
you
was
seen
this.
These three girls? Oh, no, I haven't.
Haven't heard anything about that today.
About those girls. But you know, this old lady came in and she's talking about three girls getting thrown into a van. Imagine that.
Isn't that crazy?
But there's no coincidence.
And these employees just remembered it 3 months after the fact as well, or?
God, what the hell?
All three employees, the woman had discussed what she had seen with them, but they had no idea who she was. They had only seen her that one time on the 23rd. I mean, I wouldn't remember an old lady. I would remember the fact that she told me three girls were kidnapped, and then the cops and mother came in later looking for these missing girls.
Yeah. So why would she even bother to tell you? It's not like nonchalant talk. Like,
yeah.
Oh, do you have any capes in stock? Or I'm looking for some hosiery. By the way, there were just like three girls outside getting shoved into a van.
It's like a construction one or maybe a security guard. Yeah. And
like an ice cream truck. I don't know.
Speaking of ice cream, where's the food court?
Dude, I'm so hungry right now.
So hungry. I got the munchies.
You should have never said that. Man. I'm so distracted. What were you saying about girls?
I remember she said something about food.
That's right. Oh, they were trying to get some ice cream.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
That's it. When the truck went in reverse, it played ice cream truck music.
Mm. Oh.
I wanted to get the ice cream truck music for our trucks whenever they backed up.
Oh my God.
How long it took them to realize it wasn't a beeping noise.
Yes, we should do that.
That would be fun. Yeah. Fran went on record in the papers asking for the witness to step forward and tell them what she knew, promising to keep her identity a secret if that's what she wanted. But the woman never came forward.
You bitch.
Yeah, so, I mean, did she not ever see the request to come forward, or did
she
die?
Okay, so the only thing that we had was television and newspapers.
Yeah.
We didn't have a plethora of information and data and all these news outlets and social media and stuff. Yeah. We were fed what we were fed.
And this woman had to see the information about the missing girls somewhere in order to contact one of them's grandmother.
Don't tell me you're not looking in the paper for it.
Yeah.
Like, that was just too weird to see that in the parking lot. Even if you thought, you know, oh, it's probably their parents just, like, getting in their ass, you know?
Yeah.
But even if you did, and it stands out to you so much that you're going to tell three employees inside of a mall.
The day that you see it happen.
The day you see it happen. Do not tell me that you're not picking up a newspaper and reading that newspaper for any kind of information on it.
Yeah, you're trying to get some.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. And why would you call one of the girls' grandmothers and not the cops?
Yeah.
And if she called the family instead of the cops for the reward money, she didn't even give them any information, like, to where she could get the reward money if it led to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just weird all around. In the spring of 1975, the families hired a private investigator named John Swaim.
Can I just forget the and put the wine? John Wine?
John Wine. I mean, with this kind of name, you could have a very unique company name.
Yes.
But the company he owned was called Special Services.
Yeah, dang it. Why would you ruin that?
John, you just missed out on that opportunity.
That's insane.
That is insane. What kind of special services?
That's insane, John Swaim.
It's like I'm sitting next to Dr. Seuss. John has been described as being flashy and attention-seeking. He knew what to say and how to act to get attention, but never actually accomplished or uncovered any new information regarding this case. I wonder if like nobody was paying attention to him, he put his hand on his head and was like, "My word," and pretend to faint.
Oh, my Lanta. It's just so hot out here, Homer.
Help me.
Somebody blow me.
I need some special services. Here's my business card. Mr. Swaim started off with a bang by calling a press conference in March 1975 with the media and the three families. He used this conference to call out the Fort Worth police for their mishandling of the case. It seems to me that Mr. Swaim was angry with the police department for not throwing open the missing girl's files and letting him run wild with information. Mr. Swaim announced during the press conference that he believed the key to solving the missing girl's case was inside their police files. He stated that there was a recorded call between a police dispatcher and a witness from the night of the disappearance. In this call, the witness gave police a license plate number and a detailed description of the vehicle. He then went on to say that his source in the Fort Worth PD had told him that the record had been destroyed after he had asked for copies of it.
Oh.
The chief of police responded to this allegation. He stated he had no clue what John Swaim was going on about. Mr. Swaim, I object. There was no recording from the night of the disappearances, and nothing related to the case had been destroyed.
Wow.
He acknowledged that dispatcher tapes do get erased every 60 days so that they can be reused. And you, John Swaim, would know that because we talked yesterday and I told you the exact same thing yesterday. And now you're up here in front of everybody acting like you ain't never heard it before. The chief of police also said in regards to showing their files to Swaim that he wanted everything the PD had gotten. They went on to say that they never open their case files to anyone who asks that. That goes against all sorts of rules and regulations that were in place. Let me see your files.
I just want the damn files.
I don't need...
files public, I guess.
Yeah, you can put in the FIFO or whatever, Freedom of Information Act. I don't know when that went into place.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But it seems like if you had anything on the case, the family hired a private investigator, that they would give them as much information as they possibly could without...
Compromising
the case.
Yeah, I guess like... tips that were possibly legit.
Yeah, like you could, stuff you would share with the public information. Like, this is what we found. You're a PI.
Yeah.
We're not going to solve it and then give
figure
it to
it
you.
Figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you were hired.
This is what you're getting paid for, Mr. Swaim.
Mr. Swaim.
The night of the press conference, police contacted Mr. Swaim and asked him to come to the station. They must have worked out a way to work together because the very next day, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram printed that John Swaim was now praising the Fort Worth police for their cooperation. Oh. He told the Star that the police department had contacted him and verbally briefed him on the girls' files.
That's good.
Yeah, give him the information. Let him help you. In April, John Swaim claimed that he'd received information from an unnamed source that the three girls had been killed and their bodies had been left beneath a bridge near Port Lavaca, Texas. And so, Mr. Swaim arranged for hundreds of volunteers to get together on a Sunday and search under the bridges.
Oh.
The police department in Port Lavaca, which is over 300 miles away from Fort Worth, I wonder if it's to the east of Fort Worth. Like,
I'm going to look while you're talking.
Yeah, where is it in relation to Weatherford and all that? The police department in Port Lavaca, which is over 300 miles away from Fort Worth, said they had already received similar information in February and had already searched under all the bridges. but Mr. Swaim insisted they should search again because the water under the bridges in February had been 2 to 3 foot deeper than they would be right now in April. So that would have made extensive searches very difficult.
So Port Lavaca is closer to, like, Victoria, Texas, southeast from San Antonio.
Like Corpus Christi area?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Fort Worth is, like, well north of that?
It would have been just, like, a straight south shot to Port Lavaca.
Now in April, the water level should be lower so the volunteers could see more. I mean, their bodies would have had to been weighed down for them to think that they were still under the bridges. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
If they weren't there before, why would they be there now, even with the water levels lower?
I'm not sure.
The search began at 9 a.m., and by 3 p.m., John Swaim had called it off. They didn't look for very long.
Wow. Way to put in your effort.
Now, earned your money that day, Mr. Swaim. The hundreds of volunteers that had been searching that day had found nothing connected to the three girls under bridges along Highway 35. Shortly after the search had wrapped up, Mr. Swaim had a personality change again and said he now believed the girls ran away.
Oh.
Yep.
Because he can't solve it.
Yeah, so this dude is telling me that within a month, he believed the entire Fort Worth Police Department was against him and hiding important knowledge about where the girls were.
Mm-hmm.
The Fort Worth Police Department then became the most cooperative and best investigators in the state of Texas.
Besties.
Then he said the girls are dead and under a bridge, but now that the water's going down, he was going to find them. Then, nah, I'm just kidding. They definitely all ran away. I mean, I've got whiplash from this shit. If I was any of these girls' families, I'd want a fucking refund.
Yeah.
John Swaim continued to bounce back and forth on his theories and ideas of what happened to the girls. That is, until 1979, when John Swaim was found dead due to a drug and alcohol overdose. His death was ruled a suicide. Shortly after his death, Renee's mother contacted Swaim's family about getting some pictures returned that she had let Swaim borrow for his investigation. Surprisingly, she was informed that Swaim's last request was for all of his files to be burned.
What?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, like,
are you corrupt?
Are you trying to hide something? Why wouldn't you give it to the people that hired you?
Right. Okay, something funky in that situation.
There was theories that he had information related to gangs or drugs or something that if it would have gotten out, it would have put his family's life in jeopardy. And so he did it to protect his family. But, I mean, burn everything in the black filing cabinet. The girls' stuff is in the green filing cabinet. Give it to their families or give it to the police department. I think that's really messed up. Documents burned included all the work he had done on the missing Fort Worth trio case. 3 years of work was gone in an instant. Not only did they lose all the interviews, witness statements, and leads, but he had pictures of their missing daughters that they had let him borrow that had been burned.
I would be devastated.
Yeah, and like then, you know,
they're not on a computer.
They're not on a computer. They're not easily accessible. You can't get copies.
No, that's all they had.
Yeah.
Well, they probably had the negatives, but
by 1979, the case was ice cold. It had never really been on fire, though. From the start, there were no clues about what happened to the girls, and as time went on, there would not be any new facts added to the case.
Mm.
The girls' case went in the cold case section, and life continued on until the early 2000s, when their case was reopened. These investigators thought along the same lines as the original investigators. They believed the girls were taken by someone they knew. I agree with this because if they had been kidnapped in the middle of the day from a crowded parking garage, I mean, it's December 23rd, there were people everywhere.
Right.
Someone would have noticed girls kicking and screaming for help. Investigators also believed that there was more than one person involved in the kidnapping, which also makes sense because once they realized something was off, three against one, my odds are on at least one of the girls getting away, if not the two older girls working together to beat the shit out of the kidnapper so the younger one could get away. Years after the disappearance, an interview would be done with Julie's mom, and she said that Terry, Renee's boyfriend and Julie's older brother, was devastated about the disappearance. He didn't know who to mourn first, his first love or his little sister.
Aww.
He also constantly beat himself up for not going with them that day. How different would things have been if he had been with the three girls? That's something really bad to carry around all these years. He should not blame himself for this, but that's easy for me to say from a distance.
Yeah. I can imagine that.
So he's been living through this nightmare every day for 51 years.
It's a lot to deal with.
To play devil's advocate here, let's look at the three girls and see if any of them had a reason to run away. We'll start with Julie. She's 9, and Santa Claus is going to be coming in 2 days.
Not going to happen.
Her mom let her go shopping with the teenage girls. She's on a high at this point because she has no reason to leave her family. She's 9. Renee was 14 and had just received a promise ring from her boyfriend that morning. They had plans to attend a Christmas party together that evening. Renee's life seems pretty good from the outside, too. Finally, we have 17-year-old Rachel. She was newlywed and was excited about her stepson spending Christmas morning with them. Would she really run away without her car and with two reluctant participants? There are two big issues with this case that I just can't wrap my head around. The obvious issue is, how in the hell does a 17-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 9-year-old disappear in broad daylight in a crowded garage and no one saw anything?
Right.
And 51 years pass and no clue of what happened has been found. From the start, this case had no clues, no leads, absolutely nothing. It's like the three girls got out of the car and fell into a different universe. I mean, you would think if somebody did something to him, even a deathbed confession by now.
Something.
Maybe they haven't died. Maybe whatever happened to them, that person's still alive. My second bugaboo is the letter Tommy received the day after the girls vanished. I've strong doubts that the letter was from Rachel. But who would write that letter? How did the writer know Rachel's car would be parked in the parking garage by Sears? Was the letter really written the day before, or had someone hand-delivered the letter to Tommy's mailbox to throw people off their scent? So many great questions I have.
Very fantastic questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I am not the only one bothered by this letter. There's been a lot of discussion around it. One of the most talked about parts of the letter is that the letter was written in pen, but the name in the return address section of the envelope was written in pencil. Why would she use two different tools to write? It comes off as maybe Rachel wrote the letter and their kidnapper labeled the envelope. But you showed me the letter and the fonts look the same. The handwriting looks identical. The signature on the letter was also weird. The way the name was signed appeared to be R-A-C-H-E-E, and then whoever wrote it noticed the name was wrong, so they elongated the last E to look like an L. The letter was reviewed by handwriting experts, but all reviews came back as inconclusive. Analyzing the handwriting was about as deep as the investigation could get at the time. And I couldn't find an exact date, but in the early 2000s, the letter was tested for DNA, and what was found on the letter and envelope did not match any of the girls or any person in the violent offender database. That really sucks. I didn't even think about testing the letter for DNA.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I wonder if they can use any DNA they found on the letter in the genealogical DNA and see if they can find any relatives that match that DNA.
Oh my God. Wouldn't that be, like,
because
if, let's say Julie by now had a kid. And then she finds out through ancestry DNA, oh my God.
My mom was kidnapped.
What? Yeah.
That's how they've been solving a lot of cold cases the last few years. They're using that.
I know. It's an awesome
That's
tool
very there. Interesting.
And it's terrifying. I better not find that in my house. I'm telling my parents that right now. You better spill the beans.
You better let me know before I spit in this tube. My DNA is going to be out there.
Because I'm doing this test now. You sure I'm not going to find nobody else?
I better not.
You sure my daddy?
Yeah. You don't want to break anything here, Mama. Tell me the truth. If DNA testing was available in the 70s and one of their DNAs showed up somewhere, that would have been a huge morale boost that maybe they are being held and are safe and alive. Or maybe not safe, but they're at least alive. This letter also worked against the family by delaying the police investigation. The letter stated exactly what the authorities thought happened. The three girls ran away to Houston to get away from it all. I'm sure. What the hell is a 9-year-old getting away from?
I don't know. Policing back then?
Yeah. It's fine. Your leg's been chopped off by a serial killer. It is fine.
I'm sure they just ran away.
Lock your door tonight. They'll be back.
Life is hard, you know? They're teenagers. They're just sowing their oats.
Just got to let them be for a little bit. With the 9-year-old that's not related to them.
That's right.
This could have been part of the abductor's plan, and if it was, then it worked. He had plenty of time to cover his or her tracks. Always hear the first 48 hours is the most important time in a case. Mm-hmm. That's when you get the most evidence. Because of this letter, the police waited almost a month to start looking for the girls. In the 90s, Rusty, Rachel's little brother, made it his mission to find his sister and her friends. He brought on a private investigator to help him find the truth. This private investigator made some very shocking and disturbing allegations that would end up putting Rusty and Deborah, Rachel's older sister, against each other. The PI's allegations were that Deborah had been the one to abduct and possibly murder the three girls, and obviously Tommy would be involved because Deborah and Tommy were still in love after he married Rachel. Even before these allegations were made, Rusty already had a sense that Deborah knew more than what she was telling.
Dad.
Rusty wasn't the only family member that thought this either. The parents of the three missing girls also thought, at least at some time since the girls disappeared, that Deborah was involved. Renee's father was one of the most outspoken in the group, and he had felt from the beginning that Deborah had something to do with the disappearances. Because the parents thought Deborah was involved, that led them to suspect Tommy as well, because he was Deborah's first fiancé. Or he was Deborah's fiancé first. Mm. So, what if Deborah actually went to the mall with them that day? I wonder if they had proof that she didn't go to the mall, that she stayed home and slept. Because it doesn't ever say in there that it was verified that it was only the three of them and Deborah and Tommy were at the house.
But it said that she didn't want to go. So yeah. That's why she asked the other girl to go.
Yeah. But what if she was going and they just asked Rachel to go because let's bring my friend along? I don't know. I wish they would say if they verified her alibi or not.
Yeah.
If Deborah and Tommy were involved in the disappearances, then Deborah did not get what she wanted. Tommy divorced Rachel about 18 months after she disappeared. He filed the divorce reason as abandonment. Within 3 months, he was already married to someone else that was not Deborah. That relationship ended in divorce, and a few months after that, Tommy married for a third time. You're not going to believe this, but this marriage didn't last either, and they got divorced. The fourth marriage was Tommy's lucky marriage. It lasted 40 years. Ooh. All that being said, Tommy and Deborah had so much time that they could have gotten together after the disappearances, but they never did.
But you know, in any case like that, even if they wanted to be together and then they and something traumatic happened like that, there's no chance that they're going to stay together.
Yeah, that's going to come between them. And then you're not going to trust each other. I mean,
yeah.
I wonder if she kept living with Tommy after Rachel disappeared.
That would just be weird too.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to know.
That's weird that she lived with them at all.
Yeah. And that you're married to your sister's ex-fiance.
Wait a minute.
Sadly, as of 2025, Rachel, Renee, and Julie are all still missing. Mm-hmm. There has never been any clues as to what happened to them, where they went, or who was responsible for such a heartless act that destroyed three families. So please, if you haven't already, spread the word about these three girls and their stories that were cut way too short, or are they still alive out there? Hopefully, we will find out one day what really happened on December 23rd, 1974.
Mm.
The end.
That's sad.
That is sad.
Three young girls.
How many people just disappear without, like, any trace?
A lot.
Yeah, but, like, how? How is there nothing? No, it bothers me.
I would think that nowadays it would be very difficult to have that because so many people have surveillance systems, street cams. At one point or another, you're going to be seen somewhere. Yeah, back then, probably super easy.
Can they go and search their social security numbers and see if they've ever been used to get a job or something or to apply for a school? Did they use social security numbers like that back then? Because I know my mama's social security card, on it says this cannot be used as any form of identification.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Mine doesn't say it. Chris's doesn't say it. And she said that she thinks that they stopped doing it in like the 60s or 70s. They stopped putting that it couldn't be used as a form of identification on there.
Yeah, but how did they pay their taxes? They would have had to have had it to pay taxes. All right, so that was interesting and frustrating. Hopefully someone will fess up.
Man, I know. I really want to know what happened.
Me too.
Even if they don't fess up to who did it, like, at least find out what happened to them.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Were they kidnapped by a stranger? Were they kidnapped by a security guard? Did they leave with a friend and something happened?
Yeah.
Did they actually drive that car to the parking lot, or did they get kidnapped outside the surplus store?
But you would think if they left with somebody that they knew at one point, that person would have said, hey, I brought them over to blah, 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 and then they just disappeared. Or
unless that person had something to do with it.
Unless that person either had something to do with it, but by now has told somebody.
Yeah.
And you would hear about it, or if that person was involved in a kidnapping, there would be another missing person around that time.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe in Weatherford.
Maybe so.
Okay. Well, I guess we will talk to you next week with another crazy story of another crazy bitch who is
unwell. Bye.
Bye. Bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry.
That's a good way to end this one.
We appreciate you listening to our podcast. If you liked it, please give us a good rating. You can listen on your favorite podcast platform with new releases every Friday. Just search for Bitch, I'm Not Well. Send us suggestions for an episode at b.tchimnotwell@gmail.com, because Gmail won't let us use bitch. Or visit our website at www.bitchimnotwell.com for more podcasts and our fabulous merchandise.
We'll see you next week on another podcast about another crazy bitch who is truly unwell.